Tonight's reading is taken from Daniel 7. It's on page 892 in your Bibles, and we're beginning at verse 1. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream, and visions passed through his mind as he was lying on his bed. He wrote down the substance of his dream. Daniel said, "In my vision at night I looked, and there before me were the four winds of heaven churning up the great sea. Four great beasts, each different from the others, came up out of the sea. The first was like a lion, and it had the wings of an eagle. I watched until its wings were torn off, and it was lifted from the ground so that it stood on 2 feet like a man, and the heart of a man was given to it. And there before me was a second beast, which looked like a bear. It was raised up on one of its sides, and it had 3 ribs in its mouth before its teeth. It was told, 'Get up and eat your fill of flesh.' After that I looked, and there before me was another beast, one that looked like a leopard, and on its back it had 4 wings like those of a bird. This beast had 4 heads, and it was given authority to rule. After that, in my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was a 4th beast, terrifying and frightening and very powerful. It had large iron teeth. It crushed and devoured its victims, and trampled underfoot whatever was left. It was different from all the former beasts, and it had 10 horns. While I was thinking about the horns, there before me was another horn, a little one, which came up among them, and 3 of the 1st horns were uprooted before it. This horn had eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth that spoke boastfully. As I looked, thrones were set in place, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was as white as snow. The hair of his head was white like wool. His throne was flaming with fire, and its wheels were all ablaze. A river of fire was flowing, coming out from before him. Thousands upon thousands attended him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court was seated, and the books were opened. Then I continued to watch because of the boastful words the horn was speaking. I kept looking until the beast was slain and its body destroyed and thrown into the blazing fire. The other beasts had been stripped of their authority but were allowed to live for a period of time. In my vision at night I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All peoples, nations, and men of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. I, Daniel, was troubled in spirit, and the visions that passed through my mind disturbed me. I approached one of those standing there and asked him the true meaning of all this. So he told me and gave me the interpretation of these things. The 4 great beasts are 4 kingdoms that will rise from the earth. But the saints of the Most High will receive the kingdom and will possess it forever, yes, forever and ever. Then I wanted to know the true meaning of the 4th beast, which was different from all the others and most terrifying, with its iron teeth and bronze claws, the beast that crushed and devoured its victims and trampled underfoot whatever was left. I also wanted to know about the 10 horns on its head, and about the other horn that came up, before which 3 of them fell, the horn that looked more imposing than the others, and that had eyes and a mouth that spoke boastfully. As I watched, this horn was waging war against the saints and defeating them, until the Ancient of Days came and pronounced judgment in favor of the saints of the Most High, and the time came when they possessed the kingdom. He gave me this explanation. The 4th beast is a 4th kingdom that will appear on earth. It will be different from all the other kingdoms and will devour the whole earth, trampling it down and crushing it. The 10 horns are 10 kings who will come from this kingdom. After them, another king will arise, different from the earlier ones. He will subdue 3 kings. He will speak against the Most High and oppress his saints and try to change the set times and the laws. The saints will be handed over to him for a time, times and half a time. But the court will sit, and his power will be taken away and completely destroyed forever. Then the sovereignty, power, and greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven will be handed over to the saints, the people of the Most High. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all rulers will worship and obey him. This is the end of the matter. I, Daniel, was deeply troubled by my thoughts, and my face turned pale, but I kept the matter to myself.
Thank you very much, Holly. Do keep that passage open, if you would, page 892, Daniel 7, and we'll look at it together. In 1975, the Khmer Rouge started their so-called Reign of Terror in Cambodia. During that time, 2 million Cambodians, including 90% of the church, were killed, either directly or through starvation and disease. Let me read you a bit about Rada, a Christian who was forced to join a slave labour workforce and rarely allowed home to see his family. Rada was deep in the forest cutting down trees and clearing brush when he heard the news that his father had died. He pleaded desperately with the Khmer Rouge to allow him a day or so to return home, but they simply said, "Why go? You can't make him live again." Rada returned to his work, hardly able to conceal the hot anger, the outrage burning in his heart, along with all the uncertainty and grief he was struggling to overcome. When that work was finished, he was allowed to go home, and there he saw his mother. She was positioned in the doorway, bent forward, holding on to a broken-off tree limb, which served as a crutch. In her other hand, Rada noticed a few leafy twigs she had found and was about to boil for food. Her face was a death mask of grief. "Your father is dead," she said. At this, Rada leapt forward to hold her as she swayed faintly, and fresh tears began moistening the hollow, bloodshot eyes. He felt her body so light and frail against him, heaving with great sobs. Her precious baby. It too had died, slowly starved, yet so patient the way little ones are in death. Her milk had dried up, and there was nothing to satisfy its pitiable wails for nourishment. It was beyond endurance. Choking and screaming with rage, Rada threw back his head and cried, "Why have you done this to us, Lord? This is too much." Well, we might not go through the same as Rada. I doubt we will. I hope we won't. But in our own way, we too can suffer. If we haven't already, then we will, whether it be bereavement or illness, the terrible hurt there can be in relationships or family, the struggle against sin or the pain of being sinned against. There are times, there will be times, when life really hurts and things seem out of control and we cry, "Why have you done this to me, Lord? This is too much." Now, how are we meant to live for God at those times? How can we live for God when it hurts too much? Well, Daniel chapter 7 is talking about those sorts of times. So let's turn to it and see what it has to say. You'll notice in the first verse we've gone back in time from last week. We're now back in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon. And this time it's Daniel's turn to have a dream. Everyone else has been having them. Now he has one in verses 1 to 14. And this time, instead of him telling everybody else what it means, he needs an interpretation. And he gets the interpretation in verses 15 to the end. Now I've divided this up into 4 points. And the first is this. Daniel learns that if we live with God as king, then we will suffer under beastly kings. If we live with God as king, we will suffer under beastly kings. The dream starts with Daniel seeing 4 beasts. The first is like a lion, the second a bear, the third a leopard, and the fourth, well, if you look at verse 7, you'll see it's not actually like any beast. Before me there was a fourth beast, terrifying and frightening and very powerful. And the description goes on. It's so terrifying, it's beyond description. It's not like any animal. And we're told what these beasts represent in verse 17. The person interpreting it says, the four great beasts are four kingdoms that will rise from the earth. But let's ask, why are these kings or these kingdoms represented by beasts? Why is that a good picture for them? Well, in Daniel, we've had a number of allusions back to Genesis chapter 1, where God creates man in his image. And that means we're created like him, to be rulers over his world. And in Genesis 1:28, he says to us, fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish and the birds and the animals. Now, of course, we're made to rule under his rule. He might make us kings of his world, but he's the king, and so we rule under him. And because we rule under him, we are to rule like him. That is, with justice and mercy. We're to rule as he rules, in fairness and kindness. That is what being human is all about. Ruling under God and like God. And Daniel, having mentioned some of those ideas, now tells us about some kings who look not like humans, but like beasts. And the point is this, these kings don't do what humans are meant to do. They don't rule under God. They don't acknowledge him as the king. And consequently, they don't rule like God with justice and mercy. They rule selfishly and greedily and destructively. They don't do what humans are meant to do. And so they're pictured as animals, beasts. They're less than human. They are beastly kings. Now, having said that, we'll see the significance of verse 4. Have a look at verse 4. We get a lion. It has the wings of an eagle. I watched until its wings were torn off, and it was lifted from the ground so that it stood on its 2 feet like a man. And the heart of a man was given to it. Do you see what's happening? This beast is becoming more human. And this is very likely an allusion to Nebuchadnezzar. We saw last week, he was a king who did not acknowledge God. He didn't rule under God. So he's like a beast, not a human. And in fact, his judgment in chapter 4, very fittingly, was to become like a beast. He became like an animal and lived in the field, and he grew feathers of an eagle. But he changed. He acknowledged God was king. He became more human. We get a description of that in verse 4. But the point of this dream and the beast is not that all the beasts become more human. In fact, it is the complete opposite. The beasts seem to become worse. In fact, as we said, the last one is so bad, it's indescribable. And we're told particularly about one of the kings from that kingdom, the little horn we heard about in verse 8, that speaks boastfully. Now, Daniel wants to know more about this horn later on. He describes it again in verses 19 and 20. And then we get verse 21, as I watched, this horn was waging war against the saints and defeating them. This king is killing God's people. And verse 25, again, this is the little horn again. He, the little horn, will speak against the Most High and oppress his saints and try to change the set times and the laws. The saints will be handed over to him for a time, times, and half a time. God is telling Daniel, he's predicting to Daniel, that in the future, inhuman, beastly kings are going to reign. And living under them as God's people will be beastly. It will be a reign of terror. Now we can see these predictions fulfilled in history to some extent. People argue over exactly who's who, but it seems likely that the kingdoms being pictured here are Babylon, the Median and Persian kingdom, Greece, possibly Rome, people argue. The small horn, most people think, would refer to a king called Antiochus Epiphanes, who in the 2nd century BC persecuted many Jews and killed them. But the point of this chapter doesn't sort of stop there. What we're being given here is not just a prediction of those particular kings, but a pattern of what it's like living in our world. God is telling his people, he's telling us, beastly kings will come. They won't just be rulers of countries. They might be rulers of offices. They might be rulers in families. They might be rulers in colleges. And beastly kings will mean suffering for God's people. It may be at the moment those who have authority over us, those who rule us, are good to us at the moment. If so, thank God. We don't know what is to come. We don't know what beastly kings might arise in our country or in our lives, and what suffering they might bring. But there is comfort here, despite the warning. The fact that God is predicting this shows that he is in control. You see that particularly in verse 25, where the persecution is limited to a time, times, and half a time. God is setting a limit on this suffering. When suffering comes and we feel like God's absent, he's not in control, life is out of control, we can look back to this and say, well, God told me it would be like this. He's predicted already, so he's in control. I don't know why he's letting it happen, but I know he's in control. He's told me, if I live with him as king, I will suffer under beastly kings. Let's go on to Daniel's second point that he learns. That is, God's destruction of beastly kings is certain. God's destruction of the beastly kings is certain. Let's look at verse 9. The little horn is still boasting in verse 8, and then verse 9, as I looked, thrones were set in place, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was as white as snow. The hair of his head was white like wool. His throne was flaming fire, and its wheels were all ablaze. It might have felt like God was absent on earth, but now he is clearly present in all his glory and splendor as he sits on his throne. And notice why he's sitting down. End of verse 10. The court was seated and the books were opened. He's sitting down because it's time for judgment. And the judgment comes in verse 11. Then I continued to watch because of the boastful words the horn was speaking. I kept looking until the beast was slain and its body destroyed and thrown into the blazing fire. God will not tolerate beastly kings ruining his world and persecuting his people forever. He will destroy them. Now, you could say that these kingdoms are destroyed in history. That there was a time the Babylonian kingdom came to an end, and the Roman kingdom came to an end. Yet more than that, the picture here must find ultimate fulfillment in God's judgment, not in history, but at the end of history, when we all, not just world rulers, but all of us will stand before God for judgment. It might be you're someone here tonight who would say, well, I'm not really a Christian. I don't acknowledge God as my king. As we said last week, can I say, we're delighted to have you here. It's great that you're here. And please come, we'd love to talk about all these things with you. But I'm afraid there is a strong warning for you from this passage. If we don't acknowledge God as our king, he promises us judgment. That is what lies ahead for us. Judgment. It doesn't have to be that way. There can be another end for us. We'll find out about that later. But the only way to change our end is to acknowledge God as the king. If we don't do that, then this destruction is certain. You see, Daniel is seeing a dream about the future. God is saying There's no doubt about what's going to happen. Here's the future happening in front of you. It's as good as happened. The verdict is announced already. If you defy God as king, you will be judged. The Khmer Rouge, those who defy God in their lives, their destruction is certain. However, destruction is not all that God is going to do. He doesn't just want to get rid of beastly kings. He wants to put this world right and make it all that it was meant to be. And so to do that, he will establish his perfect king. That's our third point. God's establishment of his perfect king is certain. We meet God's king in verse 13. In my vision at night I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. Now the phrase like a son of man literally means like a human being. And we see immediately the contrast with the beasts. They were, verse 4, like a lion, like a bear. This is one like a human being. He doesn't rule like a beast destructively and selfishly. He is all that a human being's meant to be. Ruling under God and like God. This is God's perfect king. Verse 14, the first half. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All peoples, nations, and men of every language worshipped him. He is God's supreme king. The rest of verse 14. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. He is God's eternal king. And of course, when we get to the New Testament, we find Jesus referring to himself as the Son of Man. He says in his trial to the high priest, referring to himself, "You will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven." It's Daniel 7:13. Jesus is God's perfect king. I don't know if you've ever thought about why democracy is a good way to rule a country. It may well be you haven't thought about that. But I think we do assume democracy is a good way to rule a country. In the West, that's what we assume. And there is some truth in it. But why is it a good way to rule a country? Well, it's good because if you put one person in control, they easily turn out to be a beast and rule badly. So democracy is good simply because it limits human power. It stops one person being in control on their own. And yet, of course, democracy isn't actually a very good way to run a country. It's rather hopeless, actually, because it's so hard to get anything done. Because you haven't got any power. Its benefit that it limits power is its downfall. You haven't got the power to do what needs to be done. What we need in a perfect world is a perfect ruler. One person in charge with the power to get things done, but doing everything right. Ruling rightly, justly, mercifully. And that is what we're going to get. Jesus, God's perfect king. If living under beastly kings was beastly, living under God's perfect king will be perfect. But we might want to ask, when is this going to happen? When will Jesus, this perfect king, be crowned king and rule the world and make it all perfect? Well, one answer is when Jesus returns, when he comes back. He will, as a supreme moment, the beasts will be destroyed and this perfect king will rule. Then everyone will worship him and everything will be as it should be when Jesus returns. And yet, there is a sense in which this has already happened. When Jesus rose from the dead and ascended into heaven, he, verse 13 of our passage, approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. When Jesus ascended into heaven, he sat down at the right hand of God and was crowned king. In Acts chapter 7, a few weeks after the resurrection, Stephen is stoned to death by beastly rulers, actually. And as he dies, he says this, "Look, I see heaven opened and the Son of Man standing at the right hand of God." You see, Jesus is already there, crowned king, next to God. So there's a sense in which it's happened. And yet we're still waiting. We're still waiting for him to come back. He is the king now, but we're waiting for him to come back and when everyone will acknowledge him as the king. At the moment, people don't acknowledge him as king. The world's not as he wants it to be. His rule isn't fully implemented. And that will only happen when he returns. I don't know if you've ever gone through the experience of buying a house or a flat. It's always a nightmare. Okay, it doesn't matter who you speak to, there's always a nightmare story. Very bad thing to bring up at a dinner party, because usually everyone's got a nightmare story about buying their flat, and you just go around sharing them and never talk about anything else. Actually, having mentioned it, I feel I can now tell you my nightmare story about buying a house. When Elisa and I tried to get a mortgage, our problem was proving that Elisa existed. I have to say, it wasn't a problem I thought we might face. It's true, she's quite short, but she's definitely there. The Building Society would only accept a passport, birth certificate or driving licence, and we couldn't produce any of them, so we struggled to prove she existed. Anyway, after the nightmare of mortgages and surveys, the day arrives, the contracts are signed and all that, and the money is wired through, and the house is yours. From that moment, you own it. You're in charge of it. It's your house. Of course, you don't actually live there yet. In fact, someone else might live there at that very moment. But a few days later, maybe longer, you actually move in. And if anyone was there, they have now gone. And you start making the house what you want it to be. You make the first of many trips to IKEA. Get to know that very well. So-called convenience shopping. Always gives you a headache. You arrange the furniture, you paint the walls, and you live in your house. There is the moment of the house becoming yours, and there is the moment of you taking possession of your house and making it all you want it to be. Well, it's something like that with Jesus and this world. When he rises from the dead, that is the moment he is crowned king of the world. From that moment, it's his. He owns it. He's in charge. But then there's the moment when he moves in and takes possession and makes everything as he wants it to be. He is crowned king. It has happened. We're still waiting for him to move in. Now, once we see that it has happened, it will happen, then there is clearly no doubt that God will establish his perfect king. There's no doubt, because it's already happened. He's already enthroned. All that's got to happen now is he's got to come back and implement his rule. You can't stop it. You can't avoid it. It is going to happen. It's already happened. It's just a matter of time now before he returns and implements his perfect rule over this world. God's establishment of his perfect king is certain. Well, that's what God's going to do. He's going to put this world right. He's going to destroy beastly kings. He's going to establish his perfect king. But to finish, let's come back to us. Where do we fit into all this? Our fourth point is this. If we live with him as king, we will live with him as kings. If we live with him as king, we will live with him as kings. Let's read verses 26 to 27. We've had the persecution of the saints by the little horn in verse 25, but verse 26, but the court will sit, and his power will be taken away and completely destroyed forever. Then the sovereignty, power, and greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven will be handed over to the saints, the people of the Most High. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all rulers will worship him and obey him. Now, as I read that, I don't think I saw anybody fall off their chair. But this is fall off your chair kind of stuff. Did you hear what verse 27 said? Verse 27, then the sovereignty, power, and greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven will be handed over to the saints, us, the people of the Most High. We will reign in this kingdom. It's as though Jesus shares his kingdom and his rule with us. Isn't that amazing? That God not only has got a place for us in his kingdom, he's got a throne for us in his kingdom. So that we rule with Jesus. Of course we rule under him, but we do rule with him, and we rule like him. Just as we were meant to. Just as we were created to. When this happens, we will be all that God made us and meant us to be. We will be truly human. And God will have put everything right in his world, and it will be perfect. And do you see verse 18? But the saints of the Most High will receive the kingdom and possess it forever. Yes, forever and ever. Well, that's quite a long time, isn't it? Forever, yes, forever and ever. This world and its kingdoms will end, but God's perfect kingdom, with us in it, enjoying him and praising him and ruling with him and under him, will never end. In 1952, a woman called Florence Chadwick tried to swim from Catalina Island to the shore of California. She'd already been the first woman to swim the English Channel both ways. The day was cold and foggy, and she could hardly see the boats that travelled alongside her. She swam for 15 hours, and it really hurt. She asked to be taken out of the water, but her trainer urged her on from the boat, keep going. Finally, it got too much, hurt too much, and she just stopped swimming in the water, and they pulled her out. The boats carried on. They found she was just half a mile short. The next day at a news conference, she said something like this. She said, I admit I found it too hard. I didn't do it. But I think that if I could have seen the shore, I would have made it. 2 months later, she tried again. It was bright and clear, and vision was perfect. And she swam the whole way. How can we live for God when it really hurts? When it feels like it hurts too much? We will only do it if we can see around us and what is ahead of us. And Daniel 7 gives us that vision that we need. It enables us to see around us so that even when things seem out of control, we know God is in control. He's told us it's coming. It's going to be hard. You're going to suffer. And it makes us able to see what is ahead of us. The certain destruction of all beastly kings. The certain establishment of Jesus, his perfect king. We look ahead, not to the shore of California. We look ahead to God's perfect kingdom, where we will live and reign with him forever. With that vision, then come what may, let's keep living for him. Let's pray together. Almighty, sovereign, heavenly Father, we thank you so much for your word tonight. Through it, we pray, you would grant us such a vision of you reigning now, sovereign and supreme. And a vision of your perfect King, Jesus, enthroned. A vision of your perfect kingdom to come, that we might live for you, come what may. For your glory we ask it. Amen.